which we now come in these last two lectures had better be built around the problem of Jewish identity. There are obviously two ways of looking at the history of a minority, such as we have considered this term, from the inside and from the outside. In a sense, we have tried to do both. For it must be clear that the history of the Jews is also the history of Europe, and that both of them cannot be separated. But for a minute now, I will have to separate them to talk about this matter of Jewish identity in these last two lectures. For almost everything we have done has obviously raised this question. It was easiest to answer for those who still maintain the Jewish religion, especially Jewish Orthodoxy. But we must remember that in the West, the Orthodox were always a minority. And even in the East, the Orthodox, in crisis situation, very rarely had really the leadership. Among the notables, among the Jewish councils, which I talked about last time, you will find very few Orthodox, for they all came from the notable class into which the Haskalah had made great inroads. Now you may remember from the beginning that Moses Mendelssohn tried to build a balance between Orthodoxy and assimilation. You may remember from Mr. Orbach's lecture that the Haskalah in Eastern Europe tried to maintain a similar balance between Orthodoxy and assimilation. But it is clear in both cases, West or East, that assimilation ran away with it. The problem of identity became therefore involved with the problem of Judaism being one religion among many, and Jews being one national tribe among many. This you find still in the right-wing groups, 1933-34, that I told you about before. But this assimilation had some strength built into it. It fused, after all, with the liberalism of the early 19th century. It envisaged a world of tolerance, and above all, a world of the separation of church and state. Citizenship, after all, was given to the Jews, and by mid-19th century, they had become active citizens in their nation. But the idea of citizenship, the idea of assimilation, the idea of one religion among many, was always tied up with a special sense. And even the idea of patriotism, a sense which we call the mission of the Jews. But it is a mission which goes hand in hand with liberalism and with the pluralism I have talked about. For example, to give you one quotation about this from Walter Rathenau, as a matter of fact, it is the task of the Jews to emphasize what binds the nations together during these times of stress, to give its due to the voice of reason, that is, above all, the mission of the Jews. The mission of the Jews became intertwined, really, with the mission of liberalism and the Enlightenment. And indeed, though it was tied to the religion of the prophets were in a way detached from the rest of the biblical story. And the mission of the Jews, Jewish identity in that guise, was the mission of the Jews in terms of liberalism, the Enlightenment, and universalism. This was a deep tradition, and a tradition which, in a way, it took only the final solution to destroy. But looking back on it, we can say that this kind of mission of the Jews, this kind of assimilationist, liberal identity, was only destroyed temporarily by the Holocaust and the final solution. For it did not end in 1945. You find it surely again surfacing after the war, especially in the old communities which reconstituted themselves from native Jews. This means above all Italy, and it means above all France, subtracting the large North American immigration. But the large North American immigration chose France above Israel, and therefore it is no means clear whether that large North American immigration will not also be involved in this, because they quite consciously chose France rather than Israel. However that may be, to this kind of idea of the mission of the Jews after 1945, which certainly continues in Israel, in France, in Italy, and of course in England, England that had never been attained by any kind of persecution. The new reality of the State of Israel did not very much interfere. One might think that the idea of a double loyalty, much discussed at any rate, would interfere with such ideas. But it did not really for many. The assimilationist tradition, the concomitantist Jewishness as a religion, certainly had survived. It did not, therefore, prove a failure. It did not prove a failure in general. For what you must never forget, that the tension involved in this idea of the mission of the Jew, in this idea of citizenship and assimilation, certainly produced some of the most fruitful tentatives of European thought. We can talk about Freud, we did, about Marx, about Einstein, about many writers who were indeed a product of that tension. And it is a very open question whether a giving in to Jewish nationality will not destroy much of Jewish creativity. I mention this beside the point, because I certainly believe that it does destroy much of that kind of Jewish creativity, because that creativity comes from these tensions of assimilation, of Judaism as one religion, of the attempt to integrate, of the attempt of maintaining the mission of Judaism when liberalism was going down in Europe. That kind of tension was certainly tremendously created. It was what Nordau called, of course, the coffee house Jews. For assimilation meant participation in European culture. It meant that not only in the West, but also, as you know, for the Haskalah in the East. This should not surprise us. For after all, the whole world wanted to imitate the culture of Europe. For the whole world, the culture of Europe seemed on a higher level than their own culture, because it seemed to make for economic progress. It seemed to make for a higher standard of living. Therefore, it is only natural that the Jews in the West and Eastern Europe would like to be a part of European culture, as everyone from Africa to Asia wanted to be a part of that culture, and the Jews are no exception. We must add, of course, that liberalism, with its idea of pluralism, and separation of church and state supported the maintenance of this identification and the revival of this kind of Jewish identity is closely tied up with the tremendous revival of liberalism after the Second World War. For after all, we must not forget that though liberalism was dead or dying after 1918, after 1945, all of Western Europe became really basically liberal. And whatever the political parties were, basically they were now liberal political parties. So that the revival of liberalism really made in England, in France, and in Italy at least, that continuum much easier, that must be clear. Now assimilation from the beginning meant therefore assimilation to a culture, to an ideology. This, let me remind you, could be the nationalism of the host country. And this of course was the strongest appeal. Freud, everybody was really pulled to that to a very great extent. But it could also mean assimilation to a socialist universalism. We saw how this socialist attraction was important from the end of the 19th century onwards. And you might say, in spite of the hostility of Jews and Jews, but I would reformulate that, because of its hostility to Jews and Jews. This meant transcendence, the possibility of a real transcendence into humanity. It was a more profound assimilation. For here, there was none of the nationalism which always tended towards racism. Here there was a fusion with all humanity. That is important. How did these socialists, ethical socialists as they were, envisage it? Well, that again can be explained with a quotation from Ernst Toller, the poet who was so active in the Munich Revolution of 1918. This is what Toller said. A Jewish mother has borne me. Germany nourished me. Europe formed me. My home is the earth, and the world is my fatherland. This is the kind of idea, and it is a hell of a lot more noble idea than any other ideas that I have mentioned this term or will. This is the noble idea of these kinds of socialists. This socialism also continued after 1945, and what did not continue so strongly was the nationalist assimilation. That, the Holocaust and all of that, at least muted. There are examples of it. It had shown its true colors. But the socialist assimilation certainly continued, and after the war it looked as it might be finally a reality. After the war, in the communist part of Europe, there surfaced a whole series of Jewish leaders who had been long-time communists. I will not enumerate them all. Many of them you know. Anna Pauca in Romania, Rakosi in Hungary, a lot of theoreticians, Lukács in Hungary, Adam Schaff in Poland, and it certainly seemed that in the communist part of Europe, the age of transcendence had arrived. The problem which arises, or doesn't really arise, did these communist leaders after 1945 think of themselves as Jews at all? With the exception, perhaps, of Slunsky in Czechoslovakia, the answer must be no. Even with Slunsky, it is difficult because, as you know, Slunsky played such a leading role in the making the state of Israel possible. But he did it, after all, with the consent and support of the Soviet Union. It isn't generally known, but the arms for Israel in 1948 came from Czechoslovakia with support of the Soviet Union. And something that is much less known is that the go-between between Ben-Gurion and Slansky was none other than Ho Chi Minh. That is why, unlike all other communist leaders, Ho Chi Minh never made an anti-Zionist statement. Ho Chi Minh was the go-between. He played a very key role in the making of the state of Israel. What you have therefore here, what you have therefore here is something that cannot really be determined. But after all, what Slansky played out was Soviet policy, not probably his own preferences at all. I know what I just said is water on the treadmill of those who want to combine Zionism with radical socialism. But any judgment on that side? Well, whatever that may have been, it is certainly not true for the majority. No more than it was true for the first wave of Jewish revolutionaries from 1918 to 1920, is it true for the wave of Jewish revolutionary leaders from 1945 to 1950? They did not regard themselves as Jews. The age of transcendence was at hand. But that age was rudely cut off. The purchase of the early 50s, Stalin's anti-Semitism began it. Pro-Arab policy by the Soviet Union ended it. And in the end, no Jew could, or in fact did, have a leading position in the Soviet world. What we must say about this is that the earlier attitude which I lectured about, the communist attitude to Jew as Jew, is explainable and makes a lot of sense from the point of view of socialism. And from the point of view of socialism, it cannot be faulted. But Stalinism was something else again. The anti-Semitic purges, openly anti-Semitic purges, remember, in the early 50s, where there was already the accusation of the universal world Jewish conspiracy, now transformed into the Zionist world Jewish conspiracy. And then, of course, the purges that go on constantly. These, of course, have no roots in Marx or Kautsky. These are, in fact, directly opposed to the earlier attitude on Jews, which I illustrated to you from Marx and Kautsky. Stalin's attitude has nothing to do with this, nor does his successor's attitude. This is now a matter of Soviet foreign policy, but has nothing to do with socialism as such. Therefore, in the East, in the communist world, the socialist option was rudely cut off. But it was not so rudely cut off in the West. For Jews in the West were under no such pressures. And indeed, their ethical socialism, which you have from the beginning and which I, after all, tried to illustrate to you, that ethical socialism continued in the post-war world to provide a socialist transcendence. A socialist transcendence. The question which arises, was it really transcendence? Because in a sense, at least till the mid-60s, those kind of socialists were among themselves. They were all Jews who tried to transcend their Judaism, but they were still all Jews. This was true for the German intellectuals. This was true for men in France, like Rappaport and others. They were Jews, that was it. It was what my friend George Lichtheim called an inter-Jewish debate, really of very little interest to the Gentile audience. That was the problem with these left-wing intellectuals. That is the problem with many left-wing intellectuals. It was the problem with left-wing intellectuals. This is also the problem with Deutsche. After all, your reading in Deutsche reflects this ethical socialism. But again, the debate Deutsche started was an intra-Jewish debate and of very little interest to the Gentile world for a long time. These Jews then took Kant seriously as part of their transcendence, as part of their powerlessness into a common ethic of humanity. Obviously for them, ideology stood in the forefront and not the working class attitudes, for with the working classes they had really very little to do and obviously nothing in common. This trend continued. It continued, as you know, through Herbert Marcuse. It continued, as you know, through Georg Lukács, especially the early Lukács. Not Lukács, the man who changed his line constantly according to the party line, but the early Lukács. It continues, but at the same time, it begins to have a broader audience. That is the change. It begins, I think, and that I think one can pretty much pinpoint from the middle of the 60s. This begins to have a broader audience. That is not just a Jewish audience, but a Gentile audience in Europe and in America. An audience, of course, of students who are also kind of Jews in many ways. So, what I mean, minorities of some sort. It is still true that we have this phenomenon, as somebody remarked, that none of the many Jewish revolutionaries were, as a matter of fact, defenders of the terror. You don't find that in 1918-20, and you don't find that after 1945. So even with those who were involved in real revolutionary leadership, you still have this ethical residue. You still have a fear of terror, which is, I think, for all Jewish revolutionaries, very characteristic indeed, and it comes from this background. I would therefore put Jewish consciousness, thus transformed, high on my list of Jewish identity. High on my list of that. Especially for those who have avoided Soviet Marxism. And indeed, the socialist reality, which cut them off. For here, the Israel question became much more bothersome than in the other kind of Jewish identity I have mentioned. For here, it was not merely a matter of double loyalty, but here it was a matter indeed of an anti-Israel stand, which in the communist language slid over into an easier anti-Semitism. In other words, it became impossible to maintain what Arnold Zweig in East Germany then, looking back, speaks of an unwritten contract between Jewish intellectuals and the labor movement. Arnold Zweig formulates this unwritten contract this way. We gave them the spiritual leadership which the state hindered them from obtaining by themselves, and they guarded the security of our life and work. And there's a lot to this unwritten contract with Arnold Zweig, who was himself involved in all of this. We gave them spiritual leadership which the state hindered them from obtaining by themselves, and they guaranteed the security of our life and work. But this was not to be, and the final reason was the state of Israel. For it is clear that in anti-Zionism, the line between this and anti-Semitism was not only difficult to draw, I think myself it could rather easily be drawn, but there was no attempt to draw it. In 1952, the trial of Slonsky constantly refused to draw it. International Jewish, international Zionist became at that point, under Stalin, identical. And of course, they have remained so. The problem, therefore, was very clear that that line could not be maintained. And therefore, socialism cut off. You can see this, of course, if you ever go to Paris and you see the left-wing slogans on the Sorbonne. They start out, graffiti are very interesting, you know. They start out with down with Israel, but it becomes maybe 2 inches further down with the Jews. You now meet in Israel committed left-wing intellectuals, French, who couldn't stand it in France, and who in a very tragic exile, in this case, had to exile themselves to Israel, because that line could not really be maintained, it is not maintained, by the people of March 68. And if you ever think of French leftism and the movement of May 68, I wish I could burn it into your minds, because I was there, that next to down with Israel is down with the Jews. If you have a great feeling for that, that you must calculate into it, for this is a reality. This then an effect. This then was in a way cut off, but not entirely in the West. In France, in Eastern Europe, but not in the rest of the West. Now from what I have said so far, it must be clear that the Holocaust did not really deflect the alternatives we have discussed earlier, the past history, as much as you might think. The tragedy of the European Jews meant for many of them, especially immediately, a commitment to Zionism. But in the long run, for many European Jews, it did not mean that at all. It meant the continuation of what I have talked about before. The Zionists were a minority before the war, a small minority, please don't forget that. And they may still among European Jews be an actual minority. But the state of Israel now had financial support. Even if the support for the State of Israel, to come back to that, is largely financial and rhetoric, the fact remains that the older ideas went on if under the umbrella of the State of Israel, which became a kind of cohesive force, but largely rhetorical and financial in many ways. But what about the reverse effect of the establishment of the State of Israel? What about the reverse effect? The reverse effect is equally important. Did it do anything to the Jewish stereotype? That is important. Because if the State of Israel did something to the Jewish stereotype, then in a sense it made assimilation easier. Then in a sense it made that alternative in any way a lot easier than it was before. Did it do anything to the history of anti-Semitism? The answer to that must, I think, be really ambivalent. It did something to it in 1948 and in the 67 war. You may remember the episode, which was not played up in the American press, that 20 former SS generals sent a telegram to Eschkol saying we were wrong about the Jews after all. It did something to this stereotype. It did something to it. You could no longer talk very well about the cowardly Jew, small and puny Jew, all of that. And yet, the stereotype survived. Why did it survive? It survived because in Europe at large, really, a distinction was made between Israelis and Jews, and a clear and sharp distinction. This is important in the one country which has become the inheritor of anti-Semitism, and that country is France. Why? It didn't need much to inherit it, because you may remember the anti-Semitism in Algeria and also in Morocco. You may remember the whole history of French anti-Semitism. Obviously, it is now the classic, a new classic country of anti-Semitism, which in France now comes to the fore in any crisis. As those of you who were there in the Algerian War, for example, the anti-Semitism in the Algerian War was almost incredible, and I'm not just talking about the graffiti, which were also something, generally, without doubt. And it is no lesser person than General de Gaulle, who always made a careful distinction between Israelis and Jews, but so did people in general. And I dare say, if you look now at the history of anti-Semitism, it hasn't changed a great deal in its real ideas. But what has changed is that there is now this division between Israeli and Jews, and there is for that ample and terrific lot of evidence. So that here, the effect of the State of Israel was not immediate, and in the long run may not have been too determined for the history of anti-Semitism. What I call the reverse effect, therefore, was not really too dense. And if there are now places like Germany where anti-Semitism hardly exists, it is because of the past history and not so much because of the close alliance with the State of Israel. That, I think, must also be quite clear, and is, I think, very important to remember. This also goes over to the future. If we consider Zionism itself, the accusation of the Soviet Union and the communist countries against Zionism do two things, really. They strengthen the old anti-Semitism. Above all, of course, the idea of the universal world Jewish conspiracy. Now, it doesn't meet anymore in the cemetery in Prague, it meets in Jerusalem. So, that is about the only difference. But it also was ironic, secondly. Because about Zionism, we must never forget that the great problem in Zionism is not a problem of an aggressive nationalist. The great problem of Zionism can be illustrated in a remark once made by the famous sociologist Max Weber to Martin Buber, a remark which has much more general application. Weber told Martin Buber this: if you found another small state among other small states, you and it will stand at the periphery of history, remain unimportant, and be swept away with the stream of history. But if it happened that you could successfully construct a nation of spiritual power, then it will remain at the center of history and lasting. In other words, the accusations against Zionism, the uneasiness about Zionism, was really opposed or had no much basis in the reality of a dominant trend of Zionist thought. For it must be clear from what I have tried to tell you and from your own Hertzberg reading, that Zionists tried to do a nationalism with a human face, to borrow Dubček's phrase. A nationalism with a human face, which was neither exclusive nor aggressive. Indeed, the same kind of ethical concern which you have in liberalism, the same kind of ethical concern as I quoted to you a few minutes ago, Mondragon, the same kind of ethical concerns which you have in socialism, you have also in Zionism, and namely in the basic idea of Zionism, that the last thing is supposed to be a fusion with humanity and not an exclusive nationalism. You may say, why is this so? And the answer, I think, is very simple. It is obviously tied up with a minority. A powerful minority has a greater push to ethics than people who sit at the lever of power. That is obvious. And it may very well be tied up with this. But however that may be, it is still here a true, the same ethical concerns and universalist concerns that you see with socialism or liberalism. But in this case, something intervened which did not intervene for ethical socialists and which has not yet intervened for European liberals. Harsh reality. And the harsh reality, you all know, the harsh reality were a series of wars. The state, after all, was a state. It wasn't a coterie of intellectuals or even assimilated notables. The state was a state, and a state has to fight for its survival. A state has to use reason of state. And all of this, and indeed, I must say that this was at first a great attraction, that this was a reality, and not, as it were, as I said, a coterie of intellectuals or something like that. This was a reality, and I think I should add the excitement that was felt after the Holocaust. At first, it wore off pretty fast. By seeing a Jewish reality which acted like any other reality, namely it defended itself, it had an army, and all of this. And only in this way can it be explained that people like myself for a while supported financially the Stern Gang and things of this nature, which was bad and idiotic. But you must understand, I hate to add this at once, but I'm not a fascist, regardless of what you may think. I want to add at once here, this came out of this excitement of a reality. But in the end, of course, the reality was judged by ideals which were Zionist ideals, but which had to bend given the reality of an existing state that we must not forget. On the whole, therefore, the Zionist reality and Zionist theory didn't quite jive. It never does, you know. It never does. Did not quite jive. And that again, in my opinion at any rate, made for problems, both inside Israel, as some of you know, those interminable discussions, especially in the 50s and 60s, interminable. Why is this state different from all other states? I'm not kidding you, and my answer was always, why should it be? It's a state. A state is a state is a state. And it behaves like a state. It doesn't behave like the Messiah, it behaves like the state. If it didn't behave like the state, it would have ceased to exist a long time ago. So you have this tremendous discussion, still today, what makes Israel different? And the answer, the real answer is that even today, it has not yet developed the kind of nationalism that any other state would have developed under these circumstances. If I were to tell you what is the most astounding thing about Israel, very few things are astounding. Very much like Eastern Europe, in my opinion, in many ways, and all of that sort of thing. But what is most astounding is that it has failed to develop the kind of nationalism that you would think any other state in history has developed under these kind of circumstances. And why not? Because here, the history of Zionist nationalism does come into play. The history of Zionist nationalism was a kind of barrier. And that is why I think it is so idiotic when I hear above all people on the left talk about Zionist imperialism and aggression. I happen to know a few people in Israel who belong to the Sons of Israel movement, which is imperialist like hell. But they are such a small minority that it is almost comic. So that on the whole, it has not happened. And it has not happened again because of this past history. That is important. Now objective reality, then pressed in upon the Jews between the walls. This objective reality, then, as far as I have gone up to this moment, this objective reality then has these sides to it. First of all, it continued past history, for history is never really cut. Secondly, it added a new reality, the reality of the state of Israel. But that the difference that reality made was not as great or deep as you might think, especially for after the first enthusiasm of what's passed, as I said, the enthusiasm in which I and many others supported the Stern Gag. Once that was passed, moreover, the state of Israel suffered, it was not guilty of this, God knows, from the fact of the ideal that was put up, and the fact that it is a real state in an objective situation. But it also, and this has not been realized in that part, never got an aggressive nationalism, even when other nations did, or would have, in these circumstances, without doubt, France, perhaps not England, but France, Germany, Italy, all these nations would have had by now a most aggressive and exclusive nationalism. Israel does not. That is the whole point. The history of anti-Semitism goes on as well. It goes on as well despite Israel, because of this very great gap between Israeli and Jews, something that until 67 many Israelis accepted as well, the difference between Israeli and Jew. And there's again an objective reality, the difference is very great. It is greatest, of course, between the Israelis and the ethical socialists, but the difference is still, I think, very obvious. What does this have to do, then, with Jewish identity? For Jewish identity, it means, I think, several things, all important. It means, first of all, that the options are still open, and that the options did not change that much. That as a matter of fact, whatever you may think as individuals, the Holocaust did not really change Jewish options. But obviously not. Here you all are. I didn't meet any of you in Israel, very few. Here you are, happy bourgeois, in America, with a great future, I'm sure. All the things. That's why it was so very funny to me when you all had this adverse reaction to Moses Mendelssohn and to assimilation. I shall come back to that a little later. because that's what you are the product of. So Eastern Europe isn't very relevant to you at all. You are the product of a Western development that we have discussed. So on the other hand, the options are obviously still open, but even in Europe, as you will have understood, I have sidestepped America most of the time. Even in Europe, the options are still open. What are then the options, as far as I call? First, the options are assimilation, in the more profound way that you now know. Secondly of all, the option of an ethical socialism. And thirdly, the option, of course, of Zionism. But the option of Zionism now becomes bound up with the kind of gap between ideal and reality. And it becomes bound up with this in a very real sense. And again, I must get personal. If you have been in Jerusalem as much as I am, you've seen the American kids who've come. The ones that have the greatest difficulty in Israel are the ones that come with an idealism they have read about, but which has nothing whatsoever to do with the Israel reality. Those are the most difficult, because they will leave very soon again. Anyhow, they can't help but be disillusioned, because it's a functioning organism of a state. So that an alternative was Zionism. But that alternative, once the state came into being, was a much more difficult one than before the state came into being. That must be quite clear from what I have said. Much more difficult. Finally, the anti-Semitism remains, and the effect of the state of Israel existed. On anti-Semitism is ambivalent. I say ambivalent because you may have had some other experiences, that you were looked up greater because Israel won the Seven Days War. That is undoubtedly true. I can imagine that the victories, let us say, I know this from Green Bay, in victories, the victories increased the status. But I think largely the status of the village Jews rather than of the other. So what you have, therefore, is in victory, yes, but in the long run, I think no. And France is a leading example. Now, objective reality did press in upon the Jews and made for some more difficulties. So that on Wednesday I want to sum up further, and then I want to finally tell you what I think.